From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with writer Mary Gordon about sexual love, parental love, and the terrible uncertainties of life. Her new book, The Rest of Life, brings together three novellas. Also today, the culture of disbelief. We talk with Stephen Carter about his new book on how Americans trivialize religion. He says in contemporary America, religions are treated as just passing beliefs, almost as fads. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the final episode of I'll Fly Away, which airs tonight on PBS. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Hundreds of protesters in Haiti harassed American diplomats today and beat foreign journalists in the capital, Port-au-Prince. The officials and reporters were gathering for the arrival of a ship bringing American soldiers as part of a UN peacekeeping mission. The ship was unable to dock and dropped anchor offshore. William Spindler has more from Port-au-Prince.
Hundreds of plainclothes police auxiliaries known as attachés moved in and disrupted a ceremony to welcome the arrival of the first large contingent of U.S. troops to Haiti. The troops are part of the United Nations military and police mission. Brandishing their weapons, the attachés fired into the air and prevented U.S. Embassy staff from entering the port compound. They also attacked journalists and passers-by. There are also reports of attachés occupying national radio and television. According to a high-level United Nations source, intelligence reports warned that the right conditions for the landing of the U.S. troops had not been met. After Somalia, the same source added, they cannot take any risks.
William Spindler reporting for the BBC. The unilateral ceasefire declared by Somali faction leader Mohamed Farah Aidid appears to be holding. Mogadishu was reported to be quiet for a third day today, although U.S. warplanes flew over the Somali capital in a show of force as fresh American troops arrived on the scene. A U.N. peacekeeping official said today that the U.N. resolution calling for Aidid's arrest is still in effect, despite indications that the United States would be willing to negotiate with Aidid. Aidid supporters said today that leaders of Aidid's militia were meeting to work out a common position for negotiating with U.S. Envoy Robert Oakley. Dr. Jack Kevorkian was bound over for trial today on charges that he broke Michigan's assisted suicide law for a second time. Jerome Vaughn of member station WDET reports.
Judge Karen Khalil ordered Dr. Kevorkian to stand trial on charges he helped 73-year-old Don O'Keefe commit suicide in early September. O'Keefe, who suffered from bone cancer, died after inhaling carbon monoxide gas. Kevorkian called police to report the suicide. Kevorkian compared the court proceedings with an inquisition.
That's not a law. That's a papal bull, an edict.
Oh, sorry.
There's no crime. That's a religious crime, but not a secular crime.
The prosecution had based its case on Kevorkian's admission in a news conference that he provided the materials for an earlier suicide committed in a Detroit park. Kevorkian will be arraigned on October 26th. For National Public Radio, this is Jerome Vaughn in Detroit.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 9 points to close at 3,593.4. This is NPR News. A female FBI agent told reporters today that she's being forced to resign from the bureau in retaliation for bringing sexual harassment complaints against a supervisor. Suzanne Doucette is a 9-year veteran of the FBI. She told a news conference today that she had no choice but to resign after the FBI placed her on unpaid administrative leave and she was told that her case had been closed. The FBI has declined to comment on the case on the grounds that it doesn't comment on pending lawsuits. The Cambodian National Army plans to send Khmer Rouge defectors back into the jungle to convince their former comrades to lay down their arms and give up their fight. Almost 2,000 Khmer Rouge have defected since last May's UN-organized elections. But as many as 10,000 more are still fighting and demanding a share of power. NPR's Mary Kay Magstad reports from Bangkok.
Most of
the 2,000 or so Khmer Rouge who have defected are now serving time at a camp just outside Phnom Penh, undergoing something of a re-education program. Now, their loyalty is being tested. The government army has asked them to go back to the jungles where they once fought to convince all remaining Khmer Rouge to give up. The government has warned the guerrillas that they are now officially considered outlaws. If they don't stop fighting and reintegrate into Cambodian society, army leaders say, they will face a new and vicious offensive. Government forces are grouping around the ancient temple Preah Vihear on the Thai border, which the Khmer Rouge captured in July. If battle does break out, one general said, the army will not hesitate to use against the Khmer Rouge a ton of their own rockets, which defecting Khmer Rouge brought with them. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Bangkok.
An American, Philip Sharp, and a British researcher, Richard Roberts, have been named co-winners of this year's Nobel Prize in Medicine for their work on the structure of genes. They're credited with independently making discoveries that helped launch the field of biotechnology. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mary Gordon has said that in her new book, she wanted to explore what it's like to live in a female body. Her new book also has variations on themes she's written about in previous novels, the complications of romantic love, parental love, and spiritual devotion. Her new book, The Rest of Life, Three Novellas, was called remarkable in the New York Times Sunday Book Review. Before we talk with her, let's hear a reading from the first novella, Immaculate Man. The main character is a woman who has gone a long time without a passionate sexual involvement with a man, and she's afraid that when or if she loses this particular lover, she'll be alone again, and that it will be worse than it was before.
Do you know what it's like when you give up the idea that you'll ever again be prized? In a way, it's not so terrible. But all the songs, the stories, are about someone else, some other kind of person. You hear songs or stories, you see lovers, any age, any people just walking on arm in arm, on any kind of street. The wind can be blowing, it can be lifting sheets of newspaper, throwing whole clumps of pages into the river. You can be by a river or else on a dark street where there are looming buildings. The sun can be bright or not. It can be morning, evening. It can be a bit cold or else tropically humid. If it's cold, for example, you'll see a man take a woman's hand and chafe it. You'll see his lips saying, "You're so cold." On a languid day, she'll lean against him. "I'm so tired," she'll be saying, or, "It's so nice to lean against you like this." Or teenagers will be kissing in a shopping mall. An old woman will help her husband across the street because the light is beginning to turn. Anything can do it. Anything you see or read or hear on the radio, and you think, "That's not me. None of that is me. I won't have that anymore." You feel a bit self-pitying, a little angry, but it passes. It's not terrible. Many people live that way, a number of my friends. I expected to live that way the rest of my life. Living, knowing your body is of no concern to anyone except yourself. You worry that one day you might get sick, that you'll become a nuisance or a burden. But that's all. You know that's all your body will be to anybody else, a nuisance or a burden. No one will look at you attentively or lovingly. No gaze will ever rest on you for anything but the merest second. Then it will move on. You grow to expect that. You give up expecting anything else.
Mary, all three of the novellas in your new book are about women who love men and worry about losing them, or in one case have already lost him. What were you examining about relationships in the stories?
I think what I'm trying to examine is the place where women really are now. And I guess women of my generation, or my cohort, really, women I would say between 40 and 65, say. And we're not the women who were denied sexual experience. We're the women who have had sexual experience. And then what? So if the story isn't Anna Karenina, you know, if we haven't all ended up under the wheels of a train, where have we ended up? And it seems to me that the experience of passionate love is a frightening one for both men and women, but especially for women, I would say. two of my characters, the first two, are in relationships with men presently. One of them is with a man who was a virgin when she met him. He was 43 and still a virgin. And she's afraid that he's only with her because he didn't know any better. And now that he knows better, he'll be with someone else. And my second character is with a man who is constantly putting himself in physical danger. He's a journalist who travels to the hot danger spots of the world. And she's afraid she's going to lose him in death. And I think the reality is that if you are attached to somebody passionately, the loss of them would be a terrible thing. I think that if you do somehow place your body next to the bodily life of a man, it's not that if the man goes away, you stop living, but you live differently. And it's that differently that I wanted to explore.
I know when I was young, I once woke up one Sunday morning to the sound of my upstairs neighbor dying. And his wife, you know, lived on, became like the widow in the building. And I thought, how does someone go on like this? You know, how does a woman who's been married all her life live without a husband? And it just, everyone's attitude seemed to be end of life, game over, that's it. And I no longer feel that that's exactly what life would be. Do you know what I mean? On the other hand, like you're saying, it would just be this terrible loss. It would be a different life. You know what I mean?
One of the things, however, that interests me a lot is how people make another whole life.
Uh-huh.
And it really is a whole life. It's not a fragmented life. It's not a truncated life. I've seen actually a lot of older women who get quite a kick out of their husband's death. It's like they're suddenly free and they're suddenly able to do things that they weren't able to do. I guess what I'm always trying to say is there's no one way of experiencing it.
Mm-hmm.
There are ways of living with men. There are many different ways of living with men. There are many different ways of living without men. There are ways of kind of having part of your life with men and part of your life without men. And it's still a life. And that's enormously interesting to me. And what I'm trying to undo is that notion that women are either locked into life with a man, that equals alive, or somehow cast adrift in this miserable dark sea, and that is being without a man. And it seems to me that both being with a man and being without a man are much more equivocal and partial than people like us had been brought up to expect.
I want to get back to the first story, the story that you read from. In this story, the man is a virgin. He's a 43-year-old priest whose order has basically died out. And he becomes lovers with a woman just a few years older who works at a shelter for abused women. What interested you in the idea of writing about a 43-year-old male virgin?
Well, nobody believes me that I was really more interested in writing about a virgin than about a priest. Everybody thinks I'm being coy, but I'm really not. When I was writing the essay Good Boys and Dead Girls, I was really exploring the idea of male innocence as seen from a male point of view. And I thought a lot about what innocence might be, and it occurred to me that the paradigm in Western culture for innocence is the female virgin. I mean, we have heard about female virginity until we could all, you know, die of it. But obviously, there is such a thing as male sexual inexperience. Not every male baby came out of the womb, you know, Hugh Hefner. And so I thought, what would that be like, that sexual blankness, for a woman?
You know, there's so much that you can't convey about a book by just kind of summarizing the plot. I was thinking about it when reading the story because I was thinking on some level the idea of, you know, a male virgin who's a priest in his 40s who falls in love and really desires this woman and everything. Might sound to somebody casually listening like, oh, the Thornbirds.
It should only sell so well. yes, it is. It's exactly like the Thornbirds. Go out and buy it. It's quite similar. Go ahead.
Well, the woman character in the story gets really concerned that as her lover gets more experienced and more worldly, not only about sex, but about other things in the world, that, of course, he'll leave. You know, why would he want her now that he's becoming more and more worldly?
Well, one of the things that interests me a lot, and that every woman I know has one version or another of, I simply don't know a woman who doesn't, is the notion, I'm not desirable enough. There is somebody else out there, anywhere, who could be more desirable. And
as soon as he finds them, it's all over.
It's all over. You know, all the years I've had, everything that I've done, it'll all be wiped out because he'll see whoever it is, Michelle Pfeiffer, or Michelle Pfeiffer is the one I always fixate on. But somebody, it doesn't matter. That I think so many of us are convinced that in the blink of an eye, some strange force will take the man that we love away from us. And I really wanted to play with that because I don't exactly know if the priest will leave her or not. He might not. But she's really convinced that he will, and that becomes a part of the fabric of their love affair, even though he's constantly reassuring her that he loves her and is in fact quite desiring. Nothing silences that tormenting voice. And I think there are billion-dollar industries that are solely devoted to making women feel undesirable. And I think it's a terrible, terrible problem for women.
You're writing about women in love who are mature, women who are mature women, and women who feel very physical toward the men they're in love with. They feel that they have physically found the right match as well as emotionally found the right match.
Yes.
And I wonder if you think it's any different writing about the physical love of a woman in her 40s than writing about the, you know, physical passion of someone in their 20s, you know, who is still, or teens, who are still kind of like young and discovering things for the first time.
I think it's enormously different. I think that somebody once said to me about herself in her 18s, you know, in her teens, at that point in my life, I wasn't interested in enjoying sex. I was interested in having it. And I think that when you're young, just having sex is such an exciting or a different thing, or such a proof that you're alive or mature, that it's almost, I think it becomes a more generic experience. You know, the quality of frantic desire that I think marks youth changes, and I think it becomes deeper and it even is experienced in the body more deeply. So that to say that one has less desire when one is older is wrong, but it's almost a different sort of physical experience. And there's also a backlog of disappointment and betrayal and self-protectiveness. But I think once that is broken through, the experience is enormously deep, and in many ways I think more satisfying than you know it was when one was younger.
The couple in this story often talk about things like, can you know if you're a good person if you've never been tested?
Yes.
And there's a wonderful story. Let me ask you to tell a kind of brief version of the drowning story in the book.
Yeah. My character is swimming with her daughter when the daughter is 10. And the two of them get caught in a riptide. And the mother finds herself going into a kind of trance, and the daughter is flailing, and the mother is annoyed with the daughter, and in fact doesn't help her, just disappears into her own trance, and somebody else saves the daughter. And the mother feels that at the point in her life when her daughter most needed her, she failed her, and this haunts her. And her lover, Clement, says, no, you didn't fail. You panicked. And what you thought was a trance was not a trance. It was panic. And she doesn't quite believe him. She feels that she was tested and found wanting. And it's something that disturbs her very deeply about herself.
Does this relate to a way that you felt you'd been tested by a mother and weren't sure that you passed the
test?
It
actually happened to me.
Really?
I was in Martha's Vineyard with my daughter, and we did get caught in a riptide, and exactly what I report happened to me. And I keep going up to my daughter, this is 4 years later, and saying, I'm so sorry for the way I behaved in the riptide. And she said, you know, it was about 3 seconds, Mom. Don't worry about it. But I replay it and replay it, and I feel like this was a life and death situation, and I blew it. I really blew it.
So this really stays with you. You know, yeah. The character says, I can no longer, you know, I always used to say, I would gladly give my life for my child. And, I don't think I can say that anymore because I didn't.
Yeah, I didn't. I didn't either. And it doesn't matter to me that people who are watching it said it was 3 minutes. And if she'd really been in danger, you would have done it. I know that I didn't. And I'll never quite get over it.
I really would like to know how you got saved if you were drowning in the riptide.
Okay, this is very important for your listeners. You can get out of a riptide very easily. You just have to swim parallel to the shore. A riptide is a channel that goes straight out. And if you just, the paradox of it is if you relax and turn and swim in a different direction, you're okay quite soon. Actually, my daughter was saved by someone coming to get her. And that was interesting. Somebody came out to get her with a boogie board and forgot about me. And I just went out. But then I figured out how to get out of it. I was a strong enough swimmer, and I figured my way out.
My guest is Mary Gordon. Her new book is called The Rest of Life, 3 novellas. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Mary Gordon is my guest. I'm going to move on to the second story in your book. And in the second story, it's also about a couple. And it's also, you know, the woman is afraid that she will lose her lover. This time it's because he's a foreign correspondent and is always kind of exposing himself to revolution and, coups and wars and so on. And she works with autistic children. Well, In the New York Times in an interview, you said that your interest in autism was that you're obsessed with how difficult it is to live an ordinary bourgeois life.
Yeah.
Which is like the details of ordinary life. What got you thinking about that? And what's the connection to autism?
Well, autistic children find things that we think are very easy, enormously difficult. Getting dressed, eating can be enormously problematic for them. Walking in and out of a room can really paralyze them. Turning a light off and on can paralyze them. So I was really interested in the fact that what is defined as easy or ordinary or customary is really much more shifting than I had thought. So that, for example, I think it's really hard to keep a lot of clean clothes in your drawers at all time. But a lot of people think, well, of course you just keep a lot of clean clothes in your drawer at all time. And of course you pay your bills. And of course you don't let your mail pile up. That's just the way it is. For me, to look at my desk and not feel that there's a stack of letters I haven't answered, and then to feel terror at that, would be a miracle. And I think for an autistic child to one day be able to walk in and out of a door without terror is a miracle. So I think that what one thinks of as ordinary or the minimum requirement is really very shifting.
When you talk about your obsession with the difficulty of living an ordinary bourgeois life, do you find yourself thinking about that even more when you're sick?
Yes, absolutely.
The reason why I say that is because, like, the details of ordinary life can really be overwhelming and time-consuming and everything, but, you know, you find a way you deal with it. But when you're sick, gosh, I mean, it really saps your strength, and there's, like, no energy left for anything else, and, it just becomes kind of monumental.
And you lie in bed and you think, I may never buy food again. I may never answer the mail. I may never go to work. It is really possible that I will just lie here and become more and more filthy, starve, and die. And that when I'm sick, that always seems very likely that will happen. And then I get terrified. And then I think that makes you even sicker. But I think when you're, or if I'm extremely fatigued, I sometimes will lie in bed knowing I have to wake up and think, I simply won't do it. I won't get out of bed. I will not take a shower. I will not go to work. I will just lie here. And then everything will be destroyed, and there'll be a kind of peace in that because it'll be over. And it seems to me it would be very... The other thing that I'm obsessed with when I see homeless people is at one point they decided not to keep up. They cross some kind of line. And I'm always fascinated in what that line is. When have you gone too far to get back into the web? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that that would be really easy to do. Like, supposing you just stop paying your electric bill because you don't have any money in your checking account and you're too tired to get stamps. And you just don't pay it. And then all the power goes off. And then all the food in the house rots. And then it just goes on from there. And it seems to me it could start from the inability to buy a stamp, which could at one point very clearly to me seem to be too difficult. And I can see just letting one little thing go after another and ending up on the street.
You know, the characters that you write about are really not extraordinary people, right? They're kind of...
Exactly.
They're interesting, ordinary people. But you're, and I'm not saying this just to flatter you, but I think you're an extraordinary writer. And therefore, when you're writing about these kind of interesting, ordinary people, they are somehow able to think in extraordinary ways. You know what I mean? I think your characters are able to think more clearly and eloquently than their real-life counterparts could, because you're putting the words in their mouths.
Well, I think there's a difference between thinking eloquently and speaking eloquently.
Uh-huh.
And that's what a writer does. That is the gift that we have. I'm not convinced that that many people aren't thinking extraordinary thoughts. They simply don't have the facility to write them or even speak them. It's something that growing up working class, as I did, you really understand. That occasionally people who were enormously inarticulate and spoke 70 years of clichés will say a few extraordinary sentences. And you realize that in that inner life, there might have been a lot of quite remarkable things that were never able to be said. Everybody dreams, for example. Nobody has boring dreams. If anybody told you their dreams, they're full of details, which are highly imaginative.
So you kind of feel that what you could do is translate those thoughts into words.
Yeah, I think that's the great lesson of Joyce's Ulysses. I mean, you know, Leopold Bloom was an ordinary schmuck in Dublin. He wasn't doing very well. And the entire riches of English literature and English language are put at his disposal through Joyce. And you get this extraordinary consciousness. And I think that is the task of a writer, to give articulation to what is buried and yet quite rich in, I believe, most people.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us and for reading from your new book. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mary Gordon's new book is called The Rest of Life, Three Novellas. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Stephen Carter is a professor of constitutional law who believes in the separation of church and state, but he fears we've gone too far in trying to banish religion from public debate. We'll talk with Carter about his new book, The Culture of Disbelief, how American law and politics trivialize religious devotion. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the final episode of I'll Fly Away. It will be broadcast tonight on PBS, which will then rerun the entire series. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Somalia, Presidential Envoy Robert Oakley met again today with Somali clan leaders in talks aimed at ending UN military conflicts with fugitive factional leader General Adid and clear the way for U.S. troop pullouts. Barry Schwide reports.
Even as American envoy Robert Oakley pursues talks in Somalia, the Clinton administration role of neighboring African countries. The proposed commission to look into allegations against warlord Mohamed Farah Aidid is to be run by African leaders. And while an arrest order mandated by the UN is still out for Aidid, administration officials are de-emphasizing their accusations that he's behind the slaying of American and Pakistani peacekeepers, and Oakley is negotiating with others in Aidid's clan. It could be an attempt to divide the clan and to remove Aidid from power. More likely, given the clan's strength, it's a roundabout way of dealing with a warlord, even while he is considered responsible for peacekeepers' deaths. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher has warned that if military and police officials on Haiti do not allow U.S. troops on a U.N. peacekeeping mission to land there, then the U.N. may impose economic sanctions again. Some 200 U.S. troops were not allowed to go ashore this morning, and some foreign journalists and diplomats were attacked and threatened. U.N. officials have implied that the violence was sanctioned by Haitian military officials. A U.N. force is being sent to Haiti to help that nation move back toward democracy. Russian leader Boris Yeltsin is now on a visit to Japan, despite a state of emergency and a curfew still in effect in Moscow. Bridget Kendall of the BBC reports from Moscow.
President Yeltsin appeared intent on showing he had no fears of further unrest at home as he left for Tokyo. He declared his enemies were now locked up in a mighty fortress and the situation was under control. And instantly, his office issued a new decree ordering elections planned for December to be extended to the upper as well as the lower chamber of the future Russian parliament. That looks like a direct snub to the leaders of Russia's regions and republics. A few weeks ago, Boris Yeltsin was still trying to persuade them to back his tough line against the rebel parliament in Moscow by offering them unelected seats on a new federation council that would turn into the new parliament's upper chamber. But in dozens of local councils, the leaders defied him and backed the parliament, and now they're being punished for supporting that revolt.
Bridget Kendall reporting from Moscow. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 8.5 points to close at 3,593.41 on volume of 182 million shares. This is NPR News. German Chancellor Kohl says that he believes that NATO membership for countries of Eastern Europe is in the future. While Kohl says that a meeting in January of top-level NATO officials will most likely indicate support for former members of the Warsaw Pact, the NATO conference, he says, will also send a signal of a membership bid down the road. He said for now, association agreements are enough for East European nations. Moscow has indicated its opposition to quick membership in NATO of many East European countries. Officials in Sweden announced this morning that this year's Nobel Prize in Medicine goes to an American and British scientist for their fundamental discoveries about DNA. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
The prize will be split by Philip Sharp at MIT and British-born Richard Roberts, who made his discoveries independent of Sharp at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in New York. Both scientists were studying the properties of DNA 16 years ago when they made a startling discovery. While our genetic blueprint is encoded on long strands of DNA, they found that the crucial information isn't continuous. It's often split into pieces along the DNA and interspersed with junk that has to be edited out before the code makes sense. This unexpected and still puzzling observation is of vital importance for scientists who manipulate DNA for medical research and to scientists who are simply trying to understand how the human body works. Sharp and Roberts will share the prize, worth more than $800,000, when it's awarded later this year. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
A strong undersea earthquake shook parts of Japan early this morning. The quake that measured 6.6 on the Richter scale was far enough out to sea, though, that it caused very few injuries. The quake hit just hours after Russian President Boris Yeltsin arrived in Tokyo. Officials say that some trains were delayed by the earthquake. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In his new book, The Culture of Disbelief, Stephen Carter argues that American law and politics have trivialized religious devotion. He fears that in our efforts to prevent zealots from dominating political discourse, we've become suspicious of anyone whose public opinions are shaped by religious values. Carter says in contemporary American culture, religion is often treated like a passing belief, almost like a fad, rather than as the fundamentals on which the religious build their lives. If we try to eliminate religious belief from public discourse, he says we're asking people to behave as if their faith did not matter to them. President Clinton has said this book lays out a lot of issues that he's trying to grapple with. Carter is a professor of constitutional law at Yale University. Carter says he's not trying to tear down the wall that separates church and state.
I'm a great believer in the separation of church and state. I think it's one of the great gifts that American politics has given to the world, even though it has fewer emulators than I think that it should. But it's important to understand what it means. The separation of church and state means that the government, especially through the schools, can't be in the business of endorsing particular religions or any or the idea of religion, promoting or coercing any kind of adherence. That's why, for example, organized classroom prayer in the public school is a bad thing. But I think we make a mistake when we talk, as some people do, as though arguing from religious premises for government action represents a violation of the separation of church and state. We mustn't try to come up with conversational rules for public debate that make our politics less welcoming to people who want to speak from their religious traditions.
You write that the consistent message of American society is that whenever the demand of one's religion conflicts with what one has to do to get ahead, one's expected to ignore the religion's demand and act, quote, rationally. What kinds of conflicts are you talking about there?
One of the stories I like to tell is a story of a friend of mine who was urged by a corporate headhunter to take his involvement with the religious organization off of his resume. He was told to have people think he had no religion at all than to have them think he was involved in some serious way with a religious organization. Very often people who want to follow the dictates of their religion in ways that are contrary to what most people think is the sensible thing to do are treated as odd, irrational, and they're sometimes punished. A few years ago, the Air Force disciplined an officer, for example, for wearing a yarmulke while in uniform, in violation of military headgear regulations, which forbid the covering of the head indoors while in uniform. The message that sends is, if you want to be a part of the Air Force, if you're part of the armed forces, don't be involved in a religion that has a tradition that makes you violate our headgear regulations, which are much more important. And if you were a rational person, you would understand that. The Congress sort of overturned that by statute, I should say, but they did it by adopting a statute that says that people in military uniform may wear religious apparel as long as the apparel, as the statute puts it, is neat and conservative.
As a constitutional lawyer and scholar, and as a religious person, do the laws of the country and your religious beliefs ever come into conflict?
That's a problem that a lot of believers face. It's not a problem I've had to face so far. I'm not saying there would be no laws that conflict with my religious beliefs, but simply it's not something that I've been called upon to act on. But it is interesting that we as a nation very often don't, I think, we're not very hospitable very often to people who want to argue that the laws of the nation conflict with their religious beliefs, especially if their concern is about their religious practices. The Supreme Court just this last year struck down an ordinance in the city of Hialeah, which was essentially an effort through the guise of a sham animal protection ordinance to prevent the practice of Santeria, which is a fusion of some Roman Catholic traditions and some of the Orisha traditions from Nigeria. It's an African-American religious tradition. Many people were offended because it involves animal sacrifice. The statute, the ordinances that Hialeah adopted allow many other people to engage to kill animals, but not for ritual religious purposes, at least not for the Santeria rituals. That's an example of a kind of intolerance for people who have religious practices that are outside of the mainstream. Fortunately, the Supreme Court struck that down. It doesn't always do so. A few years ago, the Supreme Court upheld a decision by the Forest Service to build a road and allow logging in lands that were sacred to several Native American groups in California. The Native Americans argued that if the road building and logging were allowed, it would make it impossible to practice their religion. It would destroy their religious traditions. The Supreme Court said, in effect, that's just too bad. You lost in the democratic processes, and you have no recourse. The problem with that kind of approach is that religions in what sociologists refer to as the mainline, that is, mainstream Protestantism, Roman Catholicism, and mainstream Judaism, all have enough political clout to, for the most part, protect themselves from state repression. But outsider religions, marginal religions, don't have that kind of political clout. And if they lose in politics and they get no protection from the courts, then there really is nothing to stand in the way of the state's effort to destroy them.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about religion and politics. You write that religion should be a bulwark against state authority, but we must guard against the likelihood that some religious people will use their religion as an instrument of oppression. Do you keep that balance?
It's not an easy balance to keep. One of the things I think that it's important to recognize is that it's a balance the courts can't keep very well. That is, the main bulwark against religious oppression, like the main bulwark against repression of any other kind, is not the judicial system. It's the good common sense of the people of the United States. One of the reasons our history has often turned out so badly is that very often the people of the United States haven't shown much common sense or much sympathy. When they haven't done that, the courts have only rarely come to the rescue. But I think what one has to bear in mind is this, that there will always be people who will fight for causes that other people don't like. My claim is that the fact that people fighting for a bad cause use religious rhetoric doesn't make their cause more dangerous or more to be feared. One has to be sure, in criticizing a cause, that the cause itself is the enemy rather than the religious rhetoric is the enemy. Because if, as so often happens today, we treat religious rhetoric as the enemy, then we have no method for distinguishing between Martin Luther King Jr. and Pat Robertson. And it seems to me if we can't draw a distinction between them, then it's not clear what our politics are all about.
My guest is Stephen Carter. He's a professor of law at Yale University and author of the new book, The Culture of Disbelief, How American Law and Politics Trivialize Religious Devotion. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Carter, author of the new book, The Culture of Disbelief. Here's a thorny question. On the issue of creationism, and there are a lot of Christians who think that the schools should teach creationism and not evolution. You write, well, the schools shouldn't teach creationism because creationism is simply bad science. But on the other hand, if you're, you know, a person of faith and your faith tells you that, you know, man was created by God and, you know, it doesn't address the question of evolution, then why should you care what scientists say. Do you know what I'm saying? Your faith would take precedence over what the scientists say.
I really think the creationism battle is a much more difficult one than many people make it. Let me make clear, I'm not a scientific creationist. I don't buy their theories. I don't buy their science or their theology. I want my kids to learn the theory of evolution, which I believe is true. I don't want them to learn that human beings were suddenly created about 20,000 years ago, which is the theory of scientific creationism. But having said all that, I don't think the fact that someone disagrees with me and disagrees because of what their religious tradition has taught makes that person a dangerous religious fanatic. In my view, it makes them wrong in the sense that I think my science is better than theirs, but I don't think we should dismiss them blithely as some fanatic who's trying to capture the mechanisms of the public schools in order to proselytize. I think, rather, that we should recognize this is one of those horribly tragic situations in which we as a society make a choice. And we say one side wins and one side loses, and maybe it's one of the situations where one side's reasons won't convince the others. But I should say on the creationism point that one of the reasons that it's important not to dismiss the creationists as a fringe is that something like 48% of the American people say they believe the Genesis story of creation is literally true, and something like 70% of the American people say they think that creationism should be taught in schools alongside evolution. So when you say that it shouldn't be taught there, which is my position, you have to recognize you're going against the wishes of a large majority of the American people.
Yeah, but I guess this is where we're, well, I appreciate what you're saying very much, that, you know, you respect people's religions. And then there's the point at which you feel that you want to make sure that you or your children are not forced to behave in a way that contradicts either your own faith or your own freedom to choose to not have a faith. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah, well, let me look at the creationism thing a slightly different way. Let me put it a slightly different way. My answer to the creationism dilemma is that I think that parents should have a very broad right to have their children opt out of instruction in the public schools that they don't think is consistent with their religion. Now, some people say if you have this broad opt-out right for parents, that we'll become a nation of dunces. The kids won't learn anything in schools. I think that's probably not true. Even though 70% of the American people say they think creationism should be taught in the public schools, if it's not taught in the public schools, I don't think anything near 70% of the American people are going to take their kids out of the schools or out of those classes. So I don't think it's going to be a big problem. I think it's vital for us to have a core curriculum, some set of things that everybody has to learn, but I would want to define that as narrowly as possible, as opposed to letting each interest group get in, well, we need this, and we need this, and this is in the core, too. There should be a narrow core, and beyond that, I think you have to allow parents a broad opt-out right, because otherwise, what you're telling them is, what we want to do is spend their tax dollars to teach your children that your religion is wrong. And that just strikes me as not a politically successful message, and not even a morally strong or a morally appealing message to send to parents. We should respect the parents' right to raise their children in their religious traditions instead of looking, as I'm afraid the philosopher John Dewey did, instead of looking at the public schools as a way of weaning children away from their parents' religious traditions.
I'm interested where you stand on the question of medicine and religion when it's a question of, say, and this has happened several times recently, for instance, of a Christian scientist parent, and Christian scientists believe in Christian science healing, you know, in a healing of faith, and they reject the use of medicine. So if a parent rejects the use of medicine for a child, or especially if the child is dying, should the courts intervene and demand that there be medical intervention, and that the doctors should be able to disregard what the parents believe and what the parents believe is best for their child?
You raise what I think is perhaps the single most difficult question that arises for those of us who think it's important to respect the rights of parents to raise children in their religion. And I think society, for better or worse, simply has to draw a line. That is, I think it's fine for parents to use the opt-out privilege I've described to protect their children in the public schools from things that the parents feel make it harder to do religious teaching at home. I think it's fine for parents to make decisions as adults about their own health care based on their religious traditions. But I think that while I really believe we should go a great deal further than we do in accommodating differences in religious belief, I think one just has to draw a line and say there's a point at which we're talking about the well-being of a child, not simply in the sense of what are you learning in school, but is this child going to live or die?
The assumption in the mainstream with the Christian Science issue is that if the courts or some outside party doesn't intervene, then the child will die because this kind of faith will not heal the child. Only medicine will. But I think what a Christian Scientist would say is, you know, as far as they're concerned, faith often does heal, and people often die under a doctor's care. People often die in the hospital, you know what I mean, no matter what medical intervention has been tried. And that just the ultimate amount of cynicism is used when it comes to faith, and people are always giving medicine the benefit of the doubt.
Well, I think there's something to that. Death is one of the hardest things for many Americans to think about. And, of course, for many people, religious traditions have mediated the human fear of death, and that's been an important part of our history. But it's interesting. If you look at the surveys, a majority of Americans believe that God can heal diseases. A majority, a very strong majority of Americans will tell you that God works miracles today. And so although I quite recognize why our legal system really can't take that much into account, I think we should recognize also that parents who do think that perhaps their faith will heal their child, they're not outside the mainstream. They're not acting in a fashion that most Americans condemn. That's something most Americans believe is possible. That doesn't mean the parents ought to win. As I said, that's the point where you can't take a risk, and I understand that. Whatever the religious tradition may be, the point is that the parents who are trying to make this difficult judgment about the medical treatment for their child, even if their judgment is, we don't want medical treatment, and even if the state must overturn that judgment, the state should do so with reluctance. The state should do so recognizing that it is interfering with their religious life. And the state should also do so recognizing that it's not as though the parents are outside the mainstream, because parents who feel that way are not outside the mainstream.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me. I've enjoyed it.
Stephen Carter's new book is called The Culture of Disbelief. This is Fresh Air. There was some trouble in Haiti today when U.S. troops tried to go ashore. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will you have from Haiti on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll talk with a reporter who watched everything today. A U.S. ship was stopped from docking at Port-au-Prince. Reporters were beaten, diplomats threatened by plainclothes police with guns there at the port. Mike Schuster has from Moscow a chronology of the attempted rebellion that ended last week in violence. Also, the Nobel Prize for Medicine is announced. It's to be shared by an American and a British scientist. The U.S. government wants to add folic acid to enriched flour to help prevent birth defects. And David Isay visits a Christopher Columbus and Queen Isabella museum in Buffalo.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. TV seasons ago, Joshua Brand and John Falzi, the creators of Northern Exposure, introduced a new series called I'll Fly Away. NBC canceled the show last spring after two seasons, but PBS picked up the ball, promising not only to rerun all 38 episodes of the drama, but to produce and present an all-new telemovie written by Brand and Falzi and featuring the I'll Fly Away cast. That movie airs tonight on PBS prior to the series' repeat run. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
There are two types of history involved here. One is TV history. This isn't the first time public television has taken a series produced by a commercial network and bought the rights to rerun it. For instance, the TV version of The Paper Chase was shown by PBS after its run on CBS. But it wasn't until The Paper Chase moved to the Showtime cable network, after its PBS showing, that new episodes of that series were produced. So tonight's fresh installment of I'll Fly Away is a PBS first. the first time it's added a new chapter to a TV series after the networks have closed that book. The other type of history involved here is civil rights history. The NBC version of I'll Fly Away was set in the Deep South of the early 60s and looked at life there through the eyes of two principal characters. Sam Waterston played Forrest Bedford, a small-town white attorney, and Regina Taylor played Lily Harper, his black housekeeper. They're both back for tonight's telemovie, but this installment, called Here and Now, starts and ends in the present with an extended flashback in between. The opening is way too slow and much more obvious and preachy than the series ever was, but the ending is full of emotion and surprise. And the middle, which takes us back to 1962, is just as powerful and disturbing as I'll Fly Away ever was. Here's a taste of a scene between Waterston and Jason London, who plays Forrest's son Nathan in tonight's telemovie. Nathan is telling his dad about his night out with his friend Paul, a night that included an unexpected activity.
This afternoon he said, Paul Slocum's no angel. And he never was. You know what pulling is?
No, I know.
Pulling is when you cruise the back roads and you take turns holding a 2x4 out the back window. The 2x4 is to crack colored people in the back of their heads as they walk down the side of the road.
Nathan, my God.
And the first person to miss has to get out and address him as sir.
You did this.
I was in the car.
Paul Slocum could go to jail for that. He should go to jail for that. He and anyone else involved. In any way.
If you want, you can complain about a system that is unable to support I'll Fly Away on a commercial network. But I'm amazed and kind of encouraged that commercial TV could have produced something this good at all. And tonight's telemovie not only wraps things up, it serves as a perfect springboard to dive into the reruns. So if you didn't see I'll Fly Away the first time around, don't make the same mistake twice. Start watching tonight.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Technical direction from Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, brutal scenes of life and death in Sarajevo. Filmmaker Adamir Kenovich has compiled videos made by himself and other filmmakers under siege in Sarajevo. It's been described as part evening news, part horror movie. It's showing at the New York Film Festival. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.